it's not only an interest, it's a business for you, isn't it?
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, sort of gradually over the years, because I've been trying this for longer than a lot of people have, and so you sort of just sort of gradually picked up some, I suppose you'd call it expertise or experience, and so you know that is always a good thing to have. Sounds a bit cocky to say that, but you know, that's sort of what's happened. They say in the land of the blind, the man with one eye is king. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know I've read a couple of articles about your garden, you and your garden, and in one of them certainly you're hoping to attract foreign birds along with some of the flora, if you like.
Right.
Is that?
I don't remember saying that.
Is that happened? Have you had any exotic birds?
Well, exotic native birds. That's good. Having herons are exotic, aren't they? One year I had a little egret fishing in the pond.
Yes, that was mentioned, I think.
So I had a kingfisher. It's not exotic, but it's just a pretty kingfisher.
You don't expect them in your garden pond, do you?
It was the last thing I expected to see. I walked down the garden and there was this flash of turquoise flying away, and I thought, there's only one bird in England that's that colour. And I mentioned it to my wife Vicky, who said that she saw a kingfisher today, I think. She believed me, and then we saw one a few weeks later. We saw one and watched it from upstairs fishing. It was perching on a spiky agave leaf, flying into the pond, catching a fish, bringing it up into that tree over there, and bashing the little fish on the tree, and then swallowing it. We were watching it for about an hour. It was absolutely fascinating.
Was that when you had the larger pond?
That's when we had the larger pond, yeah. I'm not sure it would be sort of kingfisher friendly, but that's a memory to keep. And, you know, sparrow, hawks, probably a bird I'd like to see in the garden, just that is around, but it's not quite made it to this part of Essex, is the parakeets, the ringneck parakeets.
They're in the wild, aren't they? Really?
Yeah, they're naturalised, and they're in Kent, and they're in South London, and they're all over the place, but they're not actually here yet. But they're a bit of a mixed blessing, because they're noisy and messy and quite make a lot of damage. But they look fantastic.
They're exotic, aren't they?
Yeah, they're exotic. So that's about as exotic as I'm likely to get. Good Lord, look at this
rain. Serious rain, isn't it?
This is monsoon. This is brilliant. This is exactly what we need.
Some of these plants are used to, I suppose.
That's right. Well, and the cacti and succulents as well. They don't get an awful lot of rainfall. Well, I say that. I mean, to be honest, a lot of them get more rain than we do. It's just a different time of year. But when it rains like this. You heard that you often see. Or a term, the desert wash. There's these sort of arroyos that are made, these sort of thing where you get torrential rain like this, it rushes down the mountains and carves these rain channels into the sides of the mountain. And just exactly what they want. Probably the right time of year now as well. So
the summer's usually a big rainfall.
Oh, this is fantastic. Even the sort of jungly plants, they sort of look right when it's raining. You can almost think
in their element, so to
speak. Yeah, almost think rainforest, really. Yeah, very, very happy when it rains. We certainly need it after such a dry spring.
So, how much of the success of this garden can you put down to the fact the sort of location Facing south.
Facing south.
Surrounded by trees.
Surrounded by trees near the estuary. Yeah. Quite a lot. I'm probably a few degrees milder than even just a couple of miles further inland. If you go to Rayleigh or maybe some places in Hadley,
they wouldn't be so ideal.
Yeah, it wouldn't be such ideal. This is a very favourite spot, really.
Yeah.
Very good. The trees, the big trees are mainly to the north and east, so they filter out the coldest wind.
Yeah.
The whole garden slopes to the south and west.
So.
And so the sun is able to warm the soil up a little bit more. And we're in shouting distance of the estuary, so a big body of water which stores the warmth through the winter. That's why we saw just -8. Yeah, there's a lot of places we're getting. I had friends in around by Colchester, and they were getting -12 and -14 and temperatures like that. And it, a few degrees makes enormous difference.
Yeah.
-10 is a big sort of watershed temperature. There's a lot of plants. If you don't go below -10, there's a lot of plants that you can grow. But if you go below -10, you start to the variety of species available to you starts to drop off quite considerably. You can still have a perfectly good exotic garden if you get -15s and even -20, but you just can't grow the range of plants.
The amazing thing is, really, I mean, apart from the fact that plants themselves are growing here that don't normally, is the vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having a vision, you know, you call it an obsession, I think, but it's somebody actually needs to have the vision and to actually achieve it, you know.
I think it's just being stubborn, to be honest.
Right.
I've got an idea in my head what I want the garden to look like, and I know that I quite often can't use the particular plant that I'd like to use because I know it's going to be tender, but I will go to some lengths to try and find something that looks very similar that's going to be hardier, and I'm not scared to try growing things outside. So a lot of people, if they've gone to a lot of time and trouble and expense to find an unusual plant, they'll just want to keep it. And whereas I'm not scared to try it. And if I lose it, I think, I'll analyse why I lost it. Did I look after it properly? Did I give it the wrong conditions? All sorts of things. Did I have a freak piece of weather that killed it? Is it worth trying again? And if it's worth trying again and I can make improvements, then I'll try it again. But sometimes you just think, it's not going to work, I'll try something else.
Yes, you move on.
Move on and do something different. So, as I say, I have my greenhouse, death row, and there's all those plants waiting their turn.
But you don't, they're all for this garden, are they? I mean, or do you?
Yeah, pretty well now. I used to. Probably when you were here before, I had a little yoghurt pot nursery down the end there, and I used to get plants that were harder to come by to put in clients' gardens. But nowadays, you can get most of the plants pretty well anywhere.
Right.
I noticed last week in Lidl's.
Lidl's.
they were selling the Hardy banana, Musa Basjir. And back in the day, I was one of a handful of nurseries in the country where you could buy it, and now you can get it in Lidl. So,
you've converted a few people, haven't you?
Well, I think that the genre of exotic gardening has spread immensely, and I think a lot of that is due to the gardening programs that used to be on the television. There was the one that Alan Titchmarsh used to do, and Dermot Gavin, and people like them had an awful lot of television exposure, and they were promoting a style of garden that does not necessarily appeal to gardeners. you know, ordinary people think, oh, actually, I can make my outside space look really interesting by putting these big, you know, have a little jungle thing, or bamboo or, you know, whatever. And it opened the door to non-gardeners. And so I think this appeals to non-gardeners. And then somehow you get infected with it and you become a gardener.
Mm.
So it's good. It has a sort of a broader appeal than it used to. I used to feel that when I was doing this, you know, 25 years ago, that I was out of step with the rest of the world. And then you sort of gradually got to hear of other people. There was a chap in Leytonstone called Miles Challice, who in the mid-1980s put on a garden at the Chelsea Flower Show, which had big leaf exotic plants, and he wrote on the back of that, he wrote a book. And that sort of crystallised the thoughts of little pockets of people all over the country, and gradually there was this sort of resurgence in exotic style gardening. And now there's all sorts of books. There's a fellow in Norwich, who's another long-term, a fellow called Will Giles, who's a very long-term exotic gardener, good friend of mine, who's written a few books.
Mm.
Gardening is phenomenal. He's more uses a lot of tender plants, so it's these hugely flamboyant, colourful giant leaves that he then brings in for winter. But in the summer, his garden is sort of theatre, really, stage setting, and it's absolutely magnificent. It's another facet of the hobby, really.
Yeah. And does he open to the public?
Or he does. He's one of his main living now. Is he's opening his garden. You know, I reached that crossroads and went one way, and then he went the other way. And it's more suitable as well. He's got bigger paths and it's a slightly bigger garden, and his park coach is nearby. And
it's difficult, isn't it? Because you get people who are disabled and so on.
Yeah.
And this sort of garden, not really.
This isn't
appropriate.
This isn't geared up for it at all. No. I'm hoping my knees hold out into old age so that I can still manage to put up some sort of funicular railway going up and down the slope, or or a cable car or something.
What do they call those? Chairlifts?
Yes.
Stella? No.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the chair. Yeah, stairlift. I wouldn't change it. I think being on a slope is great. It's not so great when you leave your secateurs down the bottom of the garden and you want them at the top of the garden, and then you have to keep going backwards and forwards.
But having different levels makes it interesting.
I think different levels. You can almost not see it all at one go, and it's quite good, really. I mean, that bottom part of the garden, you don't really know is there until you get to it.
No, it completely drops away, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I've tried to do with that bottom piece, this will sound a little bit silly, but instead of what most people would try to do to make a garden, which is a jungle, is to put lots of bananas and big leaf plants that you'd see if you were in the Caribbean. I've tried to get, it sounds a bit pretentious really, but when I've driven around through Mexico, I've quite often driven through some of the tropical and subtropical areas, and when you go along the bits where they cut the road through a mountainside, you've normally got this huge explosion, this variety of growth that comes out along the road cuts, and that's sort of what I've tried to do there. I've just sort of shoved it all in to get this sort of patchwork of different textures and shapes and colours of leaves, just to look like that profusion that you see on the road cuts. It's just my own little personal take on it. It's something a bit different, really.
All these plants that grow in crevices, you know.
Yeah.
They're amazing. What's the rock that you use?
The rock is lava rock.
Right.
It's volcanic rock from Turkey.
Because it's quite distinctive, isn't it? It's
a
frown.
Yes. Again, it was something that I wanted. Mark one of the garden, I couldn't afford it, and tried to make my own, and it all fell to pieces after a few years. And so we pushed the boat out and got the real thing, but I had to order it specially. There was one rock supplier in England that listed it, but they'd never ever been asked for it, and so I was the first person to ask for it, and I had to get it in specially. But I think it's fantastic. I absolutely love it.
It looks good, doesn't it?
It looks
complementary colour.
Looks great. It's sort of very, very Canary Island.
Yes, I haven't been there.
But it's sort of the idea, really, and that sort of thing. Just reinforces that a broadness, a different sort of rock. But a huge benefit of it is that it's extremely lightweight. It weighs about a third of normal rock. It means that I could get some fairly sizable chunks and still manage to move them without using heavy machinery or anything, which is an enormous bonus.
It's sort of like pumice stone, is it?
Yes, yeah, very, very nice, similar. Very, it's like an aero bar inside.
Well, that's very handy, isn't it? And but soil underneath it? What sort of soil?
For this sort of stuff, it's very, very free-draining. In fact, it's largely a mixture of sharp sand and all-in ballast.
Right.
With very little soil.
And the existing soil underneath?
The existing soil underneath is rubbish. It's just crappy old clay.
Yeah. I wondered if you had anything better than we did.
These things need very good drainage.
Right, so it's quite a few.
It's sort of like growing stuff in a raised bed, but instead of having, you know, a rectangular bed of sleepers with the stuff in, it's, you know, sort of a slightly more naturalistic rock thing, like this cliff face.
That's
like a dry stone wall that I've backfilled with rubble. And what I would normally do is do a couple of layers. When I was building it, I did a couple of layers of rock backfilled with large chunks of rubble, because it coincided with having the extension done, and then there was a big hole in the back of the house they knocked out, and I had this huge pile of rubble that I could use, which was perfect. And so I was backfilling with rubble, blinding the rubble with this mixture of ballast and sharp sand and little bits of soil here and there, and then planting the bigger plants as I went, although a few of them are no longer there. It's winter sort of
impressive, the ones that are.
So it's all sort of just like a giant raised bed, really, the whole of this area. And then eventually the plants, the stronger growing plants, the roots will find the clay, and then they sort of establish and take off. But there's enough of the free draining stuff around the immediate
to keep them going.
Bottom of the plant that sort of helps to keep the rot away. Sometimes if they're sitting in a rich soil, the rots can root in winter. The roots can rot in winter.